Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Hi there, folks. I am here with Phil Tetlock. He's the Annenberg University Professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He holds appointments in the psychology and political science departments and the Wharton School of Business. And he and his wife are co-leaders of the Good Judgment Project, a multi-year forecasting study. In other words, what he does and what the book Super Forecasting is about, that's what we're here to talk with him about, Super Forecasting, the Art and Science of Prediction, is he tests in some ways the predictive forecasting abilities of normal people, you and me, or people who are focused on spending time trying to play with their ability to forecast. And he compares it in many cases with experts, but he certainly compares it against the predictive capabilities of their forecasts. You know, if they forecast something, does it pan out? Does it not pan out in the way that they're thinking? And in this, he's learned a tremendous amount about what makes us good predictors, what makes us good forecasters. So we're going to hear a little bit about that, and we'll ask some questions about how it relates to leadership, in which forecasting and predictive capability is a huge part. So Phil, welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thank you, Peter.
So share with us a little bit about why you wrote this book to begin with. What's the big idea behind it?
The big idea is that probability estimation of real-world events is a skill that can be cultivated and is worth cultivating, and a lot of people are not aware of that.
So in other words, it's not just a talent. There's a skill that we can develop around it.
That's right. There certainly is a minimum level of intelligence and open-mindedness that's required for participating in a tournament. But the forecasters who worked with us and eventually were elevated to the status of super forecasters, I don't believe they're more intelligent than the average intelligence analyst working inside the U.S. government. I don't think they're more open-minded than those analysts are. I don't think they're harder working than those analysts are. I think the big difference between our super forecasters and intelligence analysts and major pundits and so forth is that our super forecasters believe that it's possible to assign probability estimates to the questions that the intelligence community poses, whereas many intelligence analysts and many pundits think that is impossible.
So describe a little bit when you mean probability assessments, meaning they're able to say, I think there's a 70% chance that X, Y, or Z is going to happen within a certain time frame.
That's right. So if we're playing poker and I ask you, we just have a freshly shuffled deck, and I say, what's the probability of drawing the ace of spades? It's 1 out of 52, obviously. It's a little less than 0.02. And nobody disagrees that it's possible to make probability estimations in a situation like poker. But is it possible to make probability estimations for things like terrorism events or whether Greece is going to leave the Eurozone? Whether Putin is or going to be up to more mischief in the Ukraine, or whether there'll be a violent Sino-Japanese clash in the East China Sea. These seem like unique historical events that defy probability estimation. So the people who are on board with probability estimation when it comes to poker, they look at these situations and they shrug and they say it's impossible. Now, you only know what's impossible until you try. And what we did in the forecasting tournaments is we tried. And we discovered that it was possible for people to learn to make better probability estimates for these types of events, that it was possible for talented amateurs to outperform many difficult benchmarks. And so this is a skill that can be cultivated and is worth cultivating. And if you think the President of the United States would be better off with more accurate probability estimates on his desk, then this is a project worth doing.
And so what are some of the key ways in which people are able to forecast, you know, come up with probabilities of these events that seem so improbably probabilistic?
Well, one of the things they do is they look for comparison classes. This is what Danny Kahneman calls the outside view. And what our best forecasters do is they start with Kahneman's outside view and they work in. So to take a simple example, if you're attending a marriage and you see a happy couple and they look delightfully happy, and someone has the bad taste of asking you, how likely is this couple to stay married? Your answer is going to be based, if you're an ordinary human being, on the inside view. You're going to say, these people look sensationally happy. This marriage couldn't possibly dissolve. Maybe 2% likelihood of divorce. Now, of course, we all know that the base rate, the statistical baseline of divorce in this country is much higher than 2%. it varies across SES and socioeconomic status and other variables, but it's somewhere between 30 and 50%. So a super forecaster would typically, a super forecaster's initial hunch about the marriage dissolving would be anchored around that initial base rate. And then the super forecaster would make adjustments based on assessments of the personalities of the characters involved and so forth. So they start in, with the outside and they work inside. And in doing that, very much increases the likelihood that their probability estimates will be in the ballpark of correct. I can give you another example if you want, or if I'm going on too long, you should.
No, that's great. I think that example is a great example, and I'd love to hear another one. I think this idea, it's kind of this naive realism, right? That if I, in some ways, that if I think everybody's like me, I'm going to look at them and I'm going to make some assessments about who they are based on that thought, as opposed to stepping outside and looking at the statistics and then working backwards from there. Did I understand that correctly?
That's absolutely right. Naive realism is dangerous to your accuracy.
Yeah. So yeah, give me another example. I think the example is really interesting.
Well, it turns out that our forecasters, even when they know very little about a problem, can get leverage on the problem quite quickly. And that's another aspect of super forecasters, is what great generalists they are. They're being asked an extremely heterogeneous array of questions. They're doing really well across this array. So let's say we ask them a question about how likely is a particular dictator in sub-Saharan Africa to survive in power another year. Now, let's just say for sake of argument that virtually none of the super forecasters know who this person is, or they know very little about this person. How can they get leverage on this problem quickly? Well, one very quick way of doing it is to ask, well, given that a dictator in sub-Saharan Africa has been in power for X number of years, how likely is that leader to survive another year? And the answer is almost always very high. It's about 80 and 95% probability, depending on how you stretch out the numbers. So they're going to start with a very high probability of survival because the status quo is the more likely outcome in this kind of a situation. But then if they find out that the leader in question is 91 years old and has advanced prostate cancer, they're going to start updating that probability estimate pretty quickly. And if they discover there are riots in the capital city and there are rumors of coups, they'll update even more. But they're going to start with a pretty high probability because that's where the base rate is.
Both really great and interesting examples. You know, it seems like the more I was reading, the more this idea of confidence and humility were coming together. And I think there's something very, very powerful about that combination. I think that, you know, oftentimes insecure people, right, people with weaker egos that seem to look from the outside world like they have really strong egos because they might show as arrogant, but they actually have sort of weaker egos, so they have to kind of prop themselves up, that they don't learn very effectively because their being right is so important to their self-concept. And you really talk about the importance of being wrong. You know, when I think about good leadership, it's accepting failure, it's trying, it's willing to be wrong. And that seems to be the skill of the super forecaster. And that seems to require actually a strong ego, a tremendous amount of confidence in their abilities so that they're willing to be wrong.
That's right. You go back to the old psychodynamic, psychoanalytic writers of the mid-20th century. They had an interesting phrase for that. They called it ego resilience.
I love that phrase, ego resilience.
Deserves to be resuscitated.
It does. I will resuscitate it. We have just done that here. Ego resilience. You talk about the super forecaster as really, you know, being probabilistic, but really looking at all sides of the issue. And as I was reading, I was wondering if there's a danger, because the super forecasters on the one hand have to really be open to the data, and on the other hand, they have to make a decision, right? They have to make a decision based on what I think will happen. I'm thinking about leadership and how oftentimes if leaders are too open, they might go to analysis paralysis. What have you found for the super forecasters, the one who are really good at this, what did they do to stay open and still be decisive?
Oh, that's a great point. It is one of the big dilemmas in judgment, decision-making, and leadership is striking the right balance there. You don't become a super forecaster by lingering for a long time in the maybe zone. You're going to get a score around that of the dart-throwing chimpanzee if you only make judgments, say, approximately 50% when you have dichotomous forecasting options. So it doesn't get you very far. What they have is a property called justified decisiveness. They don't move for the sake of moving away from uncertainty, but when they see evidence, they move. And even when they see little bits of evidence, they move little bits. So that's what we call the incremental belief adjustment strategy. So as information gradually comes in that a particular presidential candidate is gaining a bit of momentum, they'll move their probabilities 1, 2, 3% in response to particular events. More inexperienced forecasters tend to have jumpier belief updates. They tend to go from 50% to 20% and then back to 40%. The super forecasters tend to be more incremental, although they're obviously capable of moving very fast when the news demands.
You talked about the challenge of super forecasters sustaining the psychological load, the idea that they're constantly out there looking at data, they're constantly thinking it through, that it's a real psychological challenge. I'm wondering if you found anything related to what helped them sustain that psychological load. It's the same psychological load that leaders face all the time, to really stay on it, to keep a debate open until they've come to a decision, really looking at all the data. It's a challenge. What did you find that the super forecasters were able to do?
They're continually making the same choice that leaders have to make, and that is how to decide. When is it worth investing a lot of cognitive effort in a problem, and when are they spinning their wheels? There are some problems that are just have a lot of irreducible uncertainty woven into them. Currency exchange markets, for example, commodity markets, those are often the graveyards of forecasters. So spending a lot of time trying to predict a long-term price fluctuation in those domains, probably not worth your while. Invest a lot of effort in that. There are other kinds of problems that seem to be more tractable and where research is more likely to pay off. And so they're pretty good at that. Plus, they worked in teams, and so they were dividing effort among each other. And these were spontaneous divisions of labor that emerged. These weren't determined by some organizational diktat. These were people working together on a volunteer basis, trying to get as much done as they could together in a cooperative way.
You said something that I really loved. It was jokingly, quote, man, you know, we'll never see a newspaper article that says man changes his mind in response to evidence. You know, that we're sort of all afraid of changing our minds. We're all afraid of being weak in a certain sense and you know, having a viewpoint and then looking at evidence and then changing it. Why is that so hard? It seems so reasonable and such a smart thing to do. Why do we have such a hard time doing it?
Well, forecasting tournaments are really unusual social situations. They're pure accuracy games. There's only one thing that matters inside a forecasting tournament, and that's what your Brier score is, or your accuracy score. That's what your teammates are depending on. That you're counting on it. You're in a competition for accuracy. You're not in a competition to see who can come up with the most rhetorical put down on the other side. You're not in a competition to see who can show the most loyalty to a particular ideological cause. You're not in that kind of a game. In the real world, people are playing lots of different games. They're lobbying for more money for their department in an organization. They're lobbying for they're pushing for their political point of view. There are lots of other games people are playing in the real world. Forecasting tournaments create this very artificial vacuum-like situation in which accuracy and only accuracy matters. And when you do that, you can achieve things that I think were previously thought very difficult or impossible.
As I was reading, I was thinking about the usefulness of the forecasting mentality in overcoming losing streaks. One of the things that I see is, and I'm not thinking about in sports so much, I'm thinking about, like, you know, any individual who just has a loss and gets psyched out, and maybe they have a confidence hit, and then they have another loss, and it seems to snowball, and they kind of end up in a streak. And I wonder what you noticed with super forecasters about kind of how they got out, you know, if they fell into a losing streak, how they got out of it.
Right. Well, acquiring the skill of making accurate probability judgments in intelligence analysis is just quite different from, say, acquiring a skill in learning to play the piano or learning to play a good game of tennis or learning to play poker. Because you can do all of the right things in the real world, and you can get burned pretty badly because the world can be quite capricious. it's as if a concert pianist devotes hours and hours of practice every day to mastering the piano, and some demon comes along every 2 or 3 weeks and changes the location of the keys, and what would previously a beautifully rehearsed piece becomes nonsense. This requires a certain amount of philosophical detachment, a recognition that even though you're doing all of the right things that normative theory, logic, and so forth would suggest you should be doing, you can still do quite badly. And I think one of the useful functions of the super forecasting teams is they do buck each other up when they get clobbered by reality, as of course even super forecasters do.
You know, I was also thinking that the very process of forecasting, right, which is recognizing probabilities, that when you have a 60% probability of something and you're going for it, when it's wrong, it's fine, because there was a 40% probability that it would be wrong. And to keep that in mind doesn't mean that your process is wrong. Now, if 100% of your 60% forecasts over time are wrong, then maybe the 60% forecast is wrong. But if you're following a process, it would stand to reason that the process continues to work effectively, even if it's wrong some of the time.
That's right. In many of the high chancy domains we've been looking at, if you can be right 2 out of 3 times, that's a great batting average, and that point you just made is not widely understood. We talk about how the New York Times journalist David Leonhardt drew the conclusion that the prediction markets got it wrong back in 2012 when they were putting a 75% probability on the Supreme Court overturning Obamacare. Now the prediction markets make hundreds of predictions. And it turns out they're pretty darn well calibrated. So when they say 75%, things haven't happened, maybe not exactly 75% of the time, but in that vicinity, which means there is a 1 in 4 chance every time they make a 75% judgment that someone, even someone as smart as David Leonhardt, is going to draw the conclusion that they're wrong. Now, that's a really important point, because it suggests that people, forecasters in the government and in business too, may often be punished for being explicit. If forecasters had said, I think there's a distinct possibility of Obamacare being overturned, no one would have the faintest idea whether they're right or wrong. Because distinct possibility, what the hell does that mean? I mean, if it is overturned, you can say, look, I told you it was a distinct possibility. If it's not, you can say, I just said it was merely a possibility. So you're covered both ways very nicely. So these vague verbiage forecasts confer political safety in Washington, D.C., and indeed in the business world. They confer political safety, but they make it very hard to learn to make better calibrated judgments. So if you're functioning in a blame game political culture, it makes it very difficult to become a super forecaster. And forecasting tournaments are kind of a safe haven for cultivating skill.
You know, the point you're making feels so important too, which is that super forecasting, or forecasting in general, and getting experience with it, is really a learning process, so that we can look back and say, were we right or were we wrong, and how do we refine our process so that we get better at this, so that we can learn from our mistakes. When you're very open about your forecast with very little detail, and one of the things you talk about in the book is time horizons, right? If I say, I know an investor who for 20 years was saying the market was going to go down, and then when it crashed in 87 and then again in 98, he said, see? And, it's like, but in that meantime, it kind of went up thousands and thousands of points. So if you have no time horizon, you'll always be right. And that's the point that you make in the book. To be an effective forecaster, there's got to be a time limit.
That's right. The ability of super forecasters to think in time is one of their most distinguishing attributes. Even broken clocks are right twice a day.
Right. And that seems critical for business leaders as well, that if they're going to make certain bets, there's a time value of money. If we're going to make certain bets for our business, we have to have a sense as to what the time frame is going to be that bet's going to play out.
Yes, exactly.
Phil Tetlock, the author of Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. It's a fantastic book. I highly suggest that you read it. I was telling Phil before the interview that as I was reading through it, I kept thinking of really interesting questions that later on in the book he answered, and I was coming up short. And I'm so happy that this conversation, that I enjoyed it as much as I did, that I hope that it was interesting and useful. Phil, thank you so much for being on the show.
It was my pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.